You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. From the Vanities, The Hive Report, a deep dive on a shallow subject, this month, underwhelming airs. Life may be an elaborate game of primogeniture, but not everyone comes out a winner in the end. Jared Kushner, Senior Advisor to the President, Historical Avatar, Ethelred the Unready. Signature Achievement, Buying His Way into Harvard. Defining Trait, Slender Neckwear. Regrettable Display of Largesse, Paying $1.8 billion for 666 Fifth. Favored Pastime, Sleepovers with Bibi. Most Valuable Inheritance, Affinity for British Tailoring. Least Valuable Inheritance, Toxic Materials in Brooklyn Apartments. Master Plan, First Husband of the United States. Vanquished Rivals, Steve Bannon, The Mooch. Sign of High Birth, Seeking Civil Arrest of 105 Former Tenants. Kardashian Spirit Animal, Scott Disick. Shari Redstone, President, National Amusements. Historical Avatar, Wallace Simpson. Signature Achievement, Evicting Nonagenarian Dad's Girlfriends. Defining Trait, Inherited Fondness for Litigation. Regrettable Display of Largesse, Attempting to Force the Marriage of CBS and Viacom. Favored Pastime, Stacking Boards with Homies. Most Valuable Inheritance, Stake in National Amusements. Least Valuable Inheritance, TV Land, CMT, Paramount Pictures. Master Plan, Selling to Verizon. Vanquished Rivals, Philippe Dahmen, Sydney Holland. Sign of High Birth, Recruited Household Staff to Spy on Dad's Girlfriend. Kardashian Spirit Animal, Chris. Kim Jong-un, Leader of the Workers' Party of Korea. Historical Avatar, Uday Hussein. Signature Achievement, Developing Nuclear Arsenal. Defining Trait, Madman Dwayne Wayne Updo. Regrettable Display of Largesse, Assassinating Half-Brother with VX Poison. Favored Pastime, Smoking Cigarettes in Children's Hospitals. Most Valuable Inheritance, Pangeri Nuclear Test Site. Least Valuable Inheritance, Centrally Planned Economy. Master Plan, Part Owner, Trump Pyongyang. Vanquished Rival, Meddlesome Uncle Jiang, the GOP. Sign of High Birth, Drinking Scotch as Constituents Eat Dog. Kardashian Spirit Animal, Chloe. Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince, Saudi Arabia. Historical Avatar, Tony Montana. Signature Achievement, Permitting Female Drivers in the Kingdom. Defining Trait, Continuing Rebuke from Amnesty International. Regrettable Display of Largesse, Imprisoning Cousins at Riyadh Ritz-Carlton. Favored Pastime, Acquiring Yachts. Da Vinci's Lesser Works. Most Valuable Inheritance, 268 billion barrels of oil. Least Valuable Inheritance, Beef with Qatar. Master Plan, Turning Iran into Lamborghini Parking Lot. Vanquished Rival, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal. Sign of High Birth, Deposed Cousin with Soft Coup. Kardashian Spirit Animal, Kim. Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister, Canada. Historical Avatar, Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. Signature Achievement, Surviving 1980s Canada. Defining Trait, Charity Striptease Act. Regrettable display of largesse. Appearance in CBC miniseries. Favored pastime, acquiring bird tattoos. Most valuable inheritance, Lothario looks. Least valuable inheritance, getting screwed by another U.S. president. Master plan, squelching Quebec nationalism. Vanquished rival, Jared Kushner. Sign of high birth, studied geography at McGill. Kardashian spirit animal, Caitlyn Jenner. Focal Point, Decorative Arts, a meditation on the most intimate and brutal accessory, the earring, by Durga Chubose. In the photos, Katharine Hepburn, 1940s, and artist Amrita Shergill. I am interested in a particular type of earring, the kind that functions not merely as a decorative accent, but as a handsome object, worthy of the sort of dignity we impart to cufflinks and neckties. Like this one, a tassel shaped like a feather duster, like a cheerleader's pom-pom in repose. Photographed in black and white, and worn by the Hungarian Indian painter Amrita Shergill, commonly referred to, albeit lazily, as India's Frida Kahlo, the piece of jewelry alters the portrait's mood. It contradicts the strict line of Shergill's middle part, her straight, dark brows. It even seems to verify the artist's potent knack for revealing sweet harmony born from discordance. Something, perhaps, we are yearning for now. The enigmatic Shergill, who died in 1941 at age 28, likely due to a failed abortion performed by her husband, a doctor, is currently experiencing a quiet but well-deserved revival. This March saw the UK reissue of Amrita Shergill, a self-portrait in letters and writings, with a foreword by Salman Rushdie. This summer, the New York Times issued a reparational obituary. Now, new eyes are finding pleasure in her measured dissonance, in mint green juxtaposed with crimson and coppery orange in Three Girls, her best-known painting, or in a woman's dejected stare, so different from the sheeny grace of her silk sari in Sumer, a portrait of Shergill's cousin. Or in this photograph of the artist with her earring, she has made art of herself. In the only photograph I've ever seen of Katharine Hepburn wearing earrings, she looks stately. Her wonderful, fast-talking impatience is captured in the sting of her tapered features. Her severe cheekbones, her morose pout painted blood red. The way her earlobe appears cinched to her jawline, as if secured in place by that tufted button pearl cluster. An exacting earring, tenacious. Only Hepburn could make a pearl cluster look tenacious. She was commanding, thoroughly modern, and headstrong. She looked comfortable and persuasive in a gown, on a skateboard, in a three-piece suit, or in sandals and khakis, rearranging the furniture on the Dick Cavett show. Earrings weren't really her thing. So, of course, I imagine Hepburn screwing in this pearl cluster or snapping it closed while she busies herself with something more important. Winning an argument. Running out the door to get on with her day. A particular intimacy is attached to watching a woman fiddle close her earrings while sliding on her shoes or speaking on the phone. That vague but practiced and nearly unconscious focus. The way our fingers take charge with some secret intelligence, the swiftness of it all. Many years ago, after a trip to India, I returned to New York with gifts for my friends. I had bought cinnamon sticks from a spice farm in Kerala and thin, white Egyptian cotton T-shirts for hot summer days. I had chosen a pair of simple silver earrings for Sarah. We were new friends, and the thought hadn't crossed my mind that I'd never seen her wear earrings before. When she opened the box, Sarah smiled but sighed, pretend hooking them into holes that were long closed over. She hadn't worn earrings for years. I experienced a new and funny feeling of disappointment. The gift was useless. Sarah seemed to sense this, and while I can't remember if what happened next was actually the next day or the next week, Sarah took the silver earring and quite violently forced it through. I'd only ever seen impromptu piercings in the movies, in those summer camp scenes. This felt not dissimilar, with a certain secret thrill. Beyond the fountains, the ultimate in Vegas luxury awaits. When you think of Las Vegas, tales of wild excursions and bright neon lights on the legendary Strip may come to mind. However, you need only to look beyond the iconic fountains at Bellagio Resort and Casino for a truly luxurious and elegant experience, complete with world-class dining and modern conveniences that make Bellagio feel like your most indulgent home away from home. The first Las Vegas resort and casino in AAA history to earn 5-diamond status, AAA's highest distinction held by only a fraction of the world's best hotels, Bellagio offers a luxury experience like no other. With a myriad of modern and spacious ultra-luxe suites available, Bellagio caters to all needs and occasions. Whether it's an entertainment-focused trip in the executive hospitality suite, serenity and relaxation in the salon suite, or views of Bellagio's majestic fountain that you're looking for in the Grand Lakeview suite. With many luxury suite bookings, guests receive an unparalleled level of service through Bellagio's Chairman's Lounge experience, providing an increased level of VIP treatment from the moment you step off the plane. Exclusive perks include limousine transportation to and from the airport, VIP check-in, concierge service, in-lounge gourmet refreshments, and even complimentary laptops and Wi-Fi on hand should that pesky job of yours require some attention during your stay. Experience unparalleled luxury on the Vegas Strip. For those in need of some serious pampering, Bellagio's 55,000-square-foot spa and salon offers Zen-influenced ambiance, along with natural treatments from around the globe. The treatment rooms include 12 skincare rooms with private showers, 4 ashiatsu and 2 Thai massage rooms, 2 Vichy rooms, a hydrotherapy room, a watsu room, a 4 and 4 couples rooms. There is also a full menu of customized salon and barber services to leave you feeling and looking your best. A true world-class dining experience awaits you at Bellagio Las Vegas. Several of the world's best restaurateurs were invited to share their invaluable expertise with Bellagio. For those with a penchant for alfresco dining, Wolfgang Puck's legendary flagship restaurant, Spago, provides beautifully situated dining in front of the fountains of Bellagio. Michelin award-winning chef Michael Mina delivers the best in sustainably harvested seafood, complemented by exquisite wines and an extensive whiskey collection at his self-titled restaurant, Michael Mina. And of course, Vegas wouldn't be Vegas without some world-class entertainment and late-night shenanigans. Guests can enjoy the theatrical romance in the timeless production of O by Cirque du Soleil, or late-night cocktails at Hyde, Bellagio's famed nightclub with indoor and outdoor seating and the best views of Bellagio's famous fountains. In the photos, Penthouse Suite. The expansive penthouse suite can connect to a tower deluxe room for an additional bedroom and offers stylish Bellagio-themed art, decor, and modern conveniences to tailor your stay. Spago. New to Bellagio, Wolfgang Puck's revolutionary Spago debuts with an art-lined interior and alfresco dining space. The chef who helped develop California cuisine offers fresh takes on his market-driven fare. The fountains. The iconic fountains of Bellagio span more than 1,000 feet and perform an aquatic ballet choreographed to music and lights with outdoor dining available overlooking this magnificent site. The spa and salon. The spa and salon offers natural treatments from around the world, 56 treatment rooms, and an extensive menu of salon and barber services for the ultimate in pampering and relaxation. Hyde is a spectacular indoor-outdoor nightlife venue that offers an award-winning mixology program and world-renowned DJs on rotation. Michael Mina Restaurant. Award-winning San Francisco-based chef Michael Mina serves the freshest ingredients from the ocean and land in a sleekly designed space where you're served by expert staff. Oh, by Cirque du Soleil. Cirque du Soleil weaves a tapestry of surrealism and European-style theater in O, featuring a world-class cast of acrobats, swimmers, divers, and characters performing in, on, and above water.
Thank you.
Now, a field trip. A visit to the home kitchen of Missy Robbins, the award-winning New York chef whose new restaurant opens this month. Counterculture. With photographs by Floteau and Warner. I've never worked in a hip restaurant. I'm just becoming hip now, Missy Robbins jokes from her apartment, sporting the chic Tilly jumpsuit she now favors over Chef White's. Hip is merely an aside to the 25 years of culinary wizardry, plus a pair of Michelin stars Robbins brings to the table, making her Brooklyn hotspot Lilia one of the toughest reservations in town. Fresh off her James Beard Award for New York City's Best Chef, Robbins opens Missy this month, a pasta palace on the site of the former Domingo Sugar Factory in Williamsburg. Louisa Strauss visited Missy Robbins. In the photos, this is my favorite pot in the world. I stole it from Spaggia, the Chicago restaurant Robbins helmed from 2003 to 2008. The perfect Negroni has 1 ounce each of gin, Carpano Antica formula vermouth, and Campari, garnished with an orange twist. I like obscure, weird cookbooks. The Splendid Table is the one I go back to for regional Italian, and Jasper White's Cooking from New England was the first one I ever had. My parents gave me this print by Jean Davis, along with the colors of an Aperol Spritz. It inspired the color scheme for my new restaurant. The design on the back of the coaster is supposed to emulate pasta without anyone knowing it. It's very abstract. I like this brand for making a simple pasta with garlic, olive oil, and anchovies at home. I use this flour for making fresh pasta. I'm at Lilia most nights, so I rarely entertain at home, but I'd like to host a red sauce night and served baked ziti and Chianti. At my last dinner party, I served tacos and champagne. This is a menu from a restaurant in Zibaio, a tiny town in Italy, that I just love. It is the definition of simplicity. This is a truffle slicer. Ralph Lauren dressed me for the James Beard Awards. For a chef, that doesn't really happen. I ended up buying the tux. from the fairground up on the roof. A constellation of creative forces celebrated the opening of an exhibition by J.R., the French artist who puts a human face on street art, by H.W. Vail. In the photos, a drone's eye view of J.R.'s mural depicting the eye of a dreamer named Mara, installed on the gallery's roof in Lower Manhattan. A tottering guest carrying two glasses of wine knocked a tiny train off this wall-mounted piece. It broke, and a jaws dropped. Rain spritzes the roof till Alicia hits the keys. Belafonte smiles. "You're so ballsy," said Keys before performing a stripped-down version of her song, No One. In the photographs by Landon Nordeman, the roof of New York's Gallery Perrotin, where the opening party was held in June. J.R., in his signature dark glasses and fedora, guided Harry Belafonte around his exhibition, gesturing excitedly at a tableau of a shipping barge to explain its connection to the Syrian refugee crisis. "I'm a big fan of J.R.'s. Everything he does is incredible," said Chris Rock. J.R., who declared, "As an artist, I have the right to fail," joined Alicia Keys on stage and narrated behind-the-scenes footage of some of his most controversial works. The worlds of art, music, and fashion collided at J.R.'s first solo gallery show in New York City. A sculpture made of toy trains. Partygoers sipped in style. A light rain spritzed art world luminaries, but the skies cleared in time for Keys' performance.
Thank you.
Director's Chair by K. Austin Collins. Citizen Spike. The filmmaker delivers the first auteur's statement of the Trump era with Black Klansmen. Opening photograph by Justin Bishop. Spike Lee, photographed during the 2018 Cannes Film Festival. "I'm not like most filmmakers," he says, "and the films I make aren't like most films." It's a cool June day in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, and seemingly everybody on DeKalb Avenue wants to say hi to Spike Lee. A woman smiles and waves as Lee and I squeeze past her flock of tiny children. People middle-aged or older, and of various races, all of them, from the looks of it, old school, no bullshit, New York types. Not our way. A couple of hipsterish white guys smile hello as we cross the street. A barkeep waves. Lee, 61, breezes through it all, talking and walking at an athletic pace. He's got on Nike track pants and a red and black jacket emblazoned with the name of his production company, 40 Acres and a Mule, whose South Elliott Place headquarters we're headed to. We pass Fort Greene Park's rolling hillocks, specked with sunbathers, frisbee nerds, and the occasional kissing couple, most of them young, white. A black postman, face beaming as he crosses our path, waves and says, "Hey, how you doing, Spike?" in a chipper, bushy-tailed voice. "You'll remember the park if you've seen the movie," Lee says. He's talking She's Gotta Have It, his provocative debut feature from 1986, about the sexual liberation of a young black woman named Nola Darling. "Shot that in 12 days," he says. "I didn't know what I was doing." When we meet, he's 10 days into a 47-day shoot for season 2 of Netflix's TV adaptation of the movie. It's filming just a few blocks behind us, in front of what was once Lee's middle school. I came to talk to Lee about his new work. Somehow I got a brief tour of his life. Marking a 34-year career arc from the crisp, stylish, black-and-white Nola Darling of the 80s, to the 5K episodic version you can stream on your cell phone, with a quick detour through Lee's adolescence besides. Back in 1985, Lee, 3 years out of NYU Film School, shot the original for $175,000. The new show likely burns through more than that in a single day, if last season's budget is any indication, a sign of Netflix's deep pockets, but also an indication of how much has changed in the last 3 decades in Fort Greene, certainly, and especially for Spike Lee. Lee has made more than 20 features, including consensus classics like Malcolm X, whiz-bang moneymakers like Inside Man, overlooked curiosities like Girl 6, and contentious political agitations like Bamboozled. He's made flashy studio pictures and crowd-funded arthouse fodder, epic documentaries, Nike commercials, music videos and teleplays, TV shows, TV movies, short films, a video game. He's lost money, made money, harnessed public outrage, caused public outrage. This summer, Lee will release a new movie, Black Klansmen, that's poised to accomplish any and every combination of the above. Set in the 70s, the film spins the at times wickedly funny but ultimately terrifying story of Ron Stallworth, the first black detective in the history of the Colorado Springs Police Department, and the first, as far as Lee knows, to go undercover in the KKK. The premise sounds like a comedy sketch, specifically Dave Chappelle's Clayton Bigsby, the blind black man who becomes a white supremacist. Unlike Bigsby, Stallworth is very much real, and so are the Klan members with whom he brushes shoulders, chief among them the leader of the organization, David Duke. It's a story that, dancing along the knife's edge of realism and satire, demands a director of great style and even greater imagination. If it hadn't been a Spike Lee joint, you'd probably cite him as an influence without even seeing it, so squarely does it tie into his artistic identity. To say nothing of American identity, the movie opens on August 10th, the eve of the one-year anniversary of the Charlottesville riots, which began as a Unite the Right rally of white supremacists, including Duke. It is one of the first films that can really be called a reaction to the Trump era. Yet, when we finally sit down in 40 Acres' spacious third-floor loft, Lee tells me it didn't begin as his project. Jordan Peele called me, he says. Peele hired Lee to rewrite Black Klansman and direct it for the production company Blumhouse. The project is, nevertheless, very much Lee's, an archive of racial agitation that actively puts itself in conversation with movies such as Gone with the Wind and D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation. It pivots through the radical, sudden shifts in tone Lee is known for, nimbly but disorientingly balancing comedy and tragedy. That's another word Lee refuses to use, comedy. He's adamant that it mischaracterizes what he's going for. I never saw it as a funny film, he tells me, offering up a rapid-fire list of directors who, like him, have made passionate, serious moral tales with high doses of humor. Stanley Kubrick, Dr. Strangelove, Sidney Lumet, Network, Elia Kazan, A Face in the Crowd, and Billy Wilder, Stalag 17. It is possible, he says, it's been done before. They have very serious subject matter with humor. I'm not using the word comedy. Lee may as well have listed a number of his own movies to prove the same point, starting with She's Gotta Have It and up to and including his more recent features like 2015's Chirac, which got itself into trouble as early as the release of its first trailer for seeming too glib and colorful a take on Chicago gun violence. One of Black Klansman's singular triumphs is that its mishmash of tones and ideas adds up to something urgent, material, real. You walk away assured of its ideas. Just as it begins to make history feel like burning satire, it suddenly violently tears through the boundary between the two. What feels most outlandish in this movie is, in fact, what's closest to truth. Lee's naming of the storied white directors who've come before him to this end has a curious effect, less that he's worried we'll drop him from the canon than that he dares us to try. I tend to pretty much agree with that assessment. Lee is one of the most distinctive voices working in American movies, certainly in my lifetime. That's in part because his films tackle problems those other great mainstream directors barely or only rarely touched. When it comes to race, Hollywood has largely favored milquetoast liberal solutionism and left the radical ideas to the scrappy independents. And how Lee does it is equally essential. You could pick his style out of a crowd with ease, the stuttery editing, the constant music, the red-hot flashes of loquacious, moralistic anger. Lee imbues his movies with a style befitting his Black Brooklynite and, yes, decidedly middle-class upbringing. The mere idea of his movies has meaning. But critics and frustrated audiences, not nearly as taken with Lee's recent work as they were with his fabulous run in the 80s and 90s, are quick to remember that it's been a while since Lee's last hit, whatever that word means. Lee's singularity has surely increased with time. Chirac took the bare bones of Aristophanes' 2,425-year-old comedy, Lysistrata, and applied them to modern urban life, versified dialogue and all. The Sweet Blood of Jesus from 2014 remade the grit-streaked 70s cult classic Ganja and Hess, a vampiric Black romance, through the glossy fantasy of 21st-century Black luxury. Lee probably has movies like these in mind when he bristles at the slightest comparison to other directors. "I'm not like most filmmakers, and the films I make aren't like most films," he says, adding, "whether people think that's good or bad, that's just the way it is." Back on the set of She's Gotta Have It, I watched as Lee filmed a scene of Nola Darling, now played by the confident young actress DeWanda Wise, responding to the bitter pill of criticism. As in the movie, Nola Darling is a painter. I watched as her director observed each take from a video monitor across the street. "I will always be defensive about my shit," Nola says, in two takes, then three, increasingly passionate, "especially when I feel like it's misrepresented or misunderstood." Lee nodded along silently. Spike Lee remembers his critics. He remembers, for example, that David Denby, on the occasion of Do the Right Thing's 1989 release, wrote in New York Magazine that the film would likely incite racial violence. He remembers, too, that in the same issue of New York, Joe Klein suggested David Dinkins, the future black mayor of New York, would have to answer to Lee's movie, or else risk losing the election. "They said blood was on my hands," Lee tells me, "that a stick of dynamite was under every seat. To the white audience, one of them said, 'Just hope this doesn't open up in your neighborhood.' Come on, that's horrible." I didn't say so to Lee, but I sensed an alternative read on these infamous remarks, though granted, one obscured by the faulty assumptions about race and violence at their core. In a roundabout way, Denby, Klein, and others were suggesting that Lee has his finger on the pulse of a widespread, racially specific political rage. Their contention wasn't that Lee's movie would invent black anger wholesale, but rather that a movie like Do the Right Thing was incisive enough, even persuasive enough, to serve as a tipping point. His movies of the 80s and 90s were immediate in that way. There were riots, the Bensonhurst demonstrations in 1989, the Crown Heights riots of 1991, but Lee's movie was a symptom of that same anger, not the cause. If, for you, the end game of political art is a shift in politics, literally, you'd be inclined to say that Lee's power as an artist is somewhat limited. On the other hand, when years later, footage of the suffocating Eric Garner saying, "I can't breathe," with a police officer's knee pressed into his back, made the news, many of us found power in returning to the obvious cultural touch point. Do the Right Thing and the death of Radio Raheem. That's political, even if it's not politics per se. Maybe Lee doesn't see it that way. When I ask if he wants black Klansmen to make money or have a social impact, he says simply, "I am a storyteller," meaning, don't limit this to politics or money. The difficulty of some of Lee's recent work is that his storytelling can take forms that grate against our sense of what we, the politically aware public, feel we need. Lee's writing partner Kevin Wilmot says that's part of the point. This is the challenge that audiences, both black and white audiences, have to grapple with. There's truth to be had there. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.